Need to get the old hips swiveling here with some penny whistle music from West Nkosi. It's called Mazuzu. This is Lead Stories. I'm your tree's lead, and it's Friday, not any Friday. It is Free Your Mind Friday. And this is when we gather to have a weekly forum or gabfest, depending on how you see it, talking about the news of the week so far, or on any subject you think warrants further inspection or discussion or debate. It really helps if you have an opinion and that you can state that opinion as concisely as possible so that we can get as many calls in as possible. All right, 888-874-4888 is the number to call. 874-4888. In case you were wondering, no plans yet announced for the funeral of Aretha Franklin. That is expected sometime next week, because this is going to be a major, major funeral. We do know that a memorial in her honor concert has been planned for November. All right. So let's get on with our Free Your Mind Friday, 888-874-4888. What's on your mind? What do you think that you would like to share with us and see whether people react or they don't, or maybe they have a contrary point of view? This is what this is all about. It's about giving you the opportunity to state your case and to reach others with your thoughts. In so doing, we build community, and we kind of see each other in different ways, you know, depending on what the subject is. You probably have a very different opinion that may cause people to pause and rethink their own. So, I don't see any calls yet. That's very unusual. 888-874-4888. I'm waiting to see who will raise the forbidden subject. Who will raise the forbidden subject that I have not touched on at all? Let's see who's going to do that. I will give you a signal when you call in if you have raised the forbidden subject. Well, I'm of course joking, but it is a subject that I have such an entirely different take on, which is why I haven't touched it. In the scheme of things, this brings me to a topic on the very day that Aretha died. I was going to get into it. And then, of course, she takes precedence always. So I didn't get into it, but I will. Mitch from New York, you start us off today.
Good afternoon, Nutrish.
Good afternoon.
This is about Barbara Streisand and her pa not Barbara Streisand, Aretha Franklin and her passing.
Yes.
You hear some of the bourgeois people talk about her, and they speak of when she came into our neighborhoods, she was doing the chitlin' circuit. Well, I get offenses to that because if you think about chillings, that was a part of the food substance that our people had to eat when they were enslaved that nobody else wanted.
You know
So.
what? You are letting people who don't deserve it occupy way too much space in your head.
Well.
And getting you upset for no reason at all. And you're getting re upset because you actually are paying attention to this.
Well, it's
That's
not
been
only other
settled a long
people.
time ago.
No, but this isn't only other people. This is some of our own folks saying that. I mean, I was listening to a program this morning, and this gentleman he was a professor at a college. I think it was Duke University. And this is what he referred to it as. Our people, like when they went into our neighborhoods, they were entertaining us as being something below them.
Well, you must appreciate also the origin of the term. And it was, in fact, given by the artists themselves, the folks themselves who went from place to place in order to make a living. And they called it the chitlin' circuit because
Because they were
basically.
entertaining our people. I
It
mean,
wasn't
when
meant
they.
to be offensive at all. It really was
It
not
wasn't.
meant to be offensive. It was, in fact, quite a an inside joke. It was never meant to be offensive, and even the people who played the so-called chitlin' circuit were very proud that they were able to make a living, in some cases, a very good living. You take somebody like Oscar Michaud, the father of black cinema, who packed up his reels and went from town to town, place to place, to show his movies. He was the movie maker at the time, unable to secure a place, a decent place anywhere, in a theater, just like any white audience would expect. But that's what they had to do, and that brings us to the point. People put up with a lot of indignities. They did not transfer that. They did not feel inferior. They just felt that, hey, there's another way to skin this cat. We have
Yeah.
a way of surviving. So it was not meant at all, not at all. I want to emphasize that it was derogatory, not at all. They prized the term, they prized what it meant, they knew what it meant, everybody knew what it meant, and just the same, they were able to use this alternative method of franchising and of making a living, and a lot of people profited from the chitlin' circuit. So don't take offense.
Well,
To
why
take
is it
offense would
that?
be to internalize it and to give it the meaning that other folks wanted it to have. That was never the meaning from the beginning.
Well, why is it that when they went into the Caucasian neighborhoods, they didn't refer to it as that. They said,
well look,
now
that's
we've
not
crossed
true.
Over.
That's not true.
We've crossed over.
The Chitlin Circuit, every so-called minority had the equivalent of a Chitlin Circuit. The Jews had the Borscht Circuit. You know, they were not allowed in white communities. They took their theater, they took their singing, they took their concerts into their parallel version of the Chitlin Circuit. And that's how they survived. And that's why today many traditions that otherwise would have been lost continue because of these parallel systems. So the Chitlin Circuit was a parallel economy. And even though it was not meant to have that much clout and that much love returned to it in terms of the white society, that's not how it worked out. They loved it. You look at the posters, you look at the numbers of venues that actually were developed and lived for a long time as repositories of ethnic, quote-unquote, culture because of Chitlin circuits.
Oh.
That's a whole story about America, that although the general white society in so many ways tried to stamp out other people's cultures, the Poles had it, the Italians had it, Jews had it, all these groups that were reviled by so-called white America had their own cultural centers. And that's how they and their culture were preserved.
Oh, really? Well, I myself, I do. I take offense of it. You know,
Don't do that.
Like, I know, like, when she came into the Apollo Theater, like, we look forward to it. We lined up for days and days and days to listen to our music. And
yeah.
We didn't refer to these people as, we didn't know that they were referring to us as the Chitlin Circuit. Because I personally don't eat chitlins.
Chitlins referring to the unused parts of the hog that slaves and poor people in general made best use of, again, to stay alive. There's nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to take umbrage at. In fact, quite the opposite, to be very, very proud that from these humble beginnings, look at the role they played in sustaining a culture and making a ton of money. They made a lot of money. You know, you see the role of the Chitlin Circuit and other cultures had the same equivalent, the equivalent to the Chitlin Circuit. Jews could follow their Chitlin Circuit all around the country and thus preserved Jewish culture, Polish culture, German culture, this Italian culture, Irish culture. They all had their own versions of the Chitlin Circuit.
Oh.
And that is why, to this day, they have that system to thank. It was born out of American crude racism, but just the same, it was the way they survived and kept their respective cultures surviving. Thanks so much for your call, but don't feel upset about it. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Trace.
Hey.
Hey, I'm so glad that there's no buzzing in your house today.
I don't know. I think they felt very upset because my fellow residents here waged a mini war. It was just everything was in turmoil. I mean, normally you say, okay, we go to building A, and then we move to building B, and every building was under construction. And then the final place that I thought I could get a little quiet, the gym. I found four other people in the gym looking for quiet, and they were talking on the phone. So it didn't turn out well for me. But
well,
it's, it looks
really,
like it's quiet today.
Okay, so I wanted to say, yeah, you did. I mean, at one part, I was listening to this really serious, you know, you're talking really seriously. And the next thing, you know, this buzzsaw was coming in, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is terrible. Okay, I was going through my husband's locker, and sometimes things just, like, knock you on the head. So this book fell out. My husband was very well-read. And he had a book called Ruled by Secrecy by Jim Marsh. And I decided to take it out and to, you know, do a little summer reading with it. And it's really fascinating. A lot of these things we all know. We all know about the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Mellons and the Carnegies. But we, I think that today we're so uneducated and undereducated. We don't even realize what the history is because we can't even go back 100 years to understand that often we're just like the knee that's jerking to the puppeteer above. And so while I'm finding this book super interesting, I'm also listening to Gary Noll yesterday, and he had this man come on who wrote a book called Giants, the Global Power of Elite. Very, very interesting author. So I went to see him last night. But I've been talking about this for about 2 weeks because what – is really what's really making me feel, you know, compelled to talk about it is that we don't hold the people at the top responsible for anything, not anything. And yet their groups, although they're still secretive, we do know a lot of the people that are responsible, for example, global warming, where you almost can put it squarely on Rockefeller's shoulders. Because Rockefeller was the head of Standard Oil, and even though they broke them into a million pieces in the early 1900s, he just took his company and made it into smaller ones. So Esso and Exxon and Amco, all these are Rockefellers. And then they go ahead and they do this study in the 1970s and 80s on global warming, and they find out how serious it is. And instead of, letting it go forward, the information, they do everything they can to not let the information go forward, even putting all kinds of people out there that are telling you exactly the opposite. Now, for me, I always knew that this is a serious problem. I mean, since we heard about it, I think I even heard about it in elementary school and took it seriously. But now we are beyond the tipping point. And I think people should be really mad. And I think the other thing about this is that at the same time that all these things are happening at the top, and they're happening because these people are mentally ill when it comes to money. There will never be enough money for them, not in a million years. And that's why I think they have a mental illness. So we have.
You know what? I want to say something about this because we are fixated on the issue of global warming, and we, you know, there is a general consensus of opinion that it's fairly recent in its impact. We've never, ever counted the relationship between global warming and environmental genocide, if you will,
yes,
to the era of you know, really major wars.
Right.
Ancient wars.
Right. Okay.
Have to constantly remember
exactly
that every time slavery was a major capitalist endeavor, the wars against the Moors, the wars in Europe, the wars all over the world had to do with dramatic changes,
right?
Not only in the way of life, but in the way nature was assaulted. The wars against the natives here in the United States, look at the enormous, I used to not read books after I saw these pictures of it. It must have been at least 20 feet high by several hundred feet long of dead buffalo killed off by whites invading the Native American territories, and the damage they had done in that time to the ecology, total disrespect for how people, traditional people, used the land and related to the land. But we never hear about that as a consequence, too, of what it is we're suffering today.
Right.
So I'm waiting for a comprehensive kind of accounting going back way in time, perhaps even to the 1200s, not just here, but in Europe and every place where we had constant war and the impact of that on the environment.
Right. So what I was going to get to that, because what I wanted to say was that as I was reading about this and reading more in-depthly, because I certainly know about these things, but it's just getting a little bit more tweaked. But as I'm reading, I'm thinking, you know, the best thing that we can do as people is continue to have our skirmishes, because it makes things really easy for the folks at the top to keep moving these puppets here, moving the puppets along, getting them to do what they want them to do, which is war. War is the number one way of making money, absolutely the number one way of making money. And as far as they see right now, they want permanent perpetual war. You know that, too. And so we, the people on the planet, are ending up with this mess. And we're not really holding anybody responsible. And yet there's a very small handful of people that, I mean, when the disappointing part about reading.
But you got to wrap it up a bit, because we have a lot of people waiting to get up.
Okay, what I wanted to say was, I think that it would be a lot better for us to hold the people actually responsible that have done so much damage on this planet and make an effort to stop isolating each other and comparing and despairing and trying to come together more and fight on a unified field. Because the more you know this, the more you break it up, the more it's division and conquering. And I think that we allowed ourselves very much, very often, to get sucked into that instead of looking at things in a unified way. So it's just an interesting reading. And okay?
I agree with that. 888-874-4888. Thank you, Gwen. This is Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Utrecht.
Hey, wonderful Harvey. What's going on?
Well, today I'd like to talk about a very touching subject, sharing hand and neck rubs, back rubs. Basically, we live in a touchless society, and unless you have, say, a pet or a loved one or children, you're not going to get touched unless you pay out a lot of money for a massage. And a lot of people don't have, $60 for a massage or whatever it takes. And a large part of our society, especially the elderly, almost never get touched, and a lot of them can't afford a massage. And so at one point I had a program going at the North Berkeley Senior Center where I invited the elderly to share neck rubs, to, in a sense, empower them to give each other neck rubs, and it was very successful while the program was going. And what I do now is, when I meet friends, say in my local cafe, we sit there in a room for, you know, a room full of people, and everybody is fully dressed, and we share neck rubs and hand rubs while we're talking, having our coffee and joking around. And it's a wonderful experience. Everybody else in the cafe seems to really respond to it. They'll come up and they'll say, "I'm next," or something like that. And I find that sharing neck rubs and hand rubs, sitting in chairs, you can sit opposite each other or stand up and rub their neck or shoulders. And it makes people feel better. They take less medication. They become less depressed. They sleep better. They're reconnected with the world. You know, they say if babies aren't touched, they just die. So I think that due to the nature of our competitive society, where it's all competition all day, there's very little time for people to just relax and share something very simple as giving each other a nice hand rub or a neck rub or a shoulder rub. And in the comfort and safety of public places like coffee houses, it's terrific. So That's what I advocate, or even friends getting together. Instead of just sitting there talking to each other, facing each other, reach out and offer them a hand rub while you're talking to each other, and you can exchange it. So both parties get a nice little massage, and I really recommend that. As far as it actually creates deeper friendships with people, and it makes people feel better. And we take so much medication in our society. It's a large part, even the psychiatric help. A large part of it, I believe, is because we're out of touch, literally. And so, I believe that sharing neck rubs is the way to go, and it might help bring more peace to the world and make you give people a brighter outlook on their daily life.
Well, okay.
All right.
But then, I'm one of those weird people. I get uncomfortable when people rub my neck or touch my hand and whatever. I like them, I get the concept. It's a nice concept, but mm-hmm. for some reason,
Well, that's why I like doing it in public places like coffee houses, because you're surrounded by people. Everybody sits there fully clothed, and it's a kind of a very safe environment to share touching. And I find that once you start, sharing hand rubs or neck rubs or give a person a little back rub, which most people love and they need, and most people, like I say, are pretty much touchless in our society, that one does get used to it, and it's very relaxing. It's a wonderful, relaxing spirit, and I find that it really adds to the day. I feel much better. Even just giving it, I feel better. I don't even have to get it, I just giving somebody a neck rub and seeing a smile on their face and knowing that they feel they're happier, and they tell me often, oh, my neck was hurting for the longest time and it was so tight up there, and now it feels much, much better and looser. You don't have to have any special training to do it. Just kind of an easy, slow rubbing and the neck and the shoulders and the hands and the arms. It's a wonderful thing to do. I don't know. I feel literally connected with my community. And I feel that I have a very good reputation with the community because, people know that we can get back in touch.
I get it. I think it's a very good sentiment. I'm just one of those quirky people. I love giving massages, and I'm very good at it, I've been told. Very good at it. But I've been known, to get nauseous.
Oh.
And with receiving massages, I get nauseous for some reason.
Well, maybe
but
just
I'm
give
probably
them.
Probably one of those weird people.
Well, maybe maybe if you just give them instead of getting them, it would help other people, and they'd love to receive a massage from you, and that way you won't get nauseous. And at the same time, you'll be reconnected with people. There's something about connection at the physical level that is so wonderful. It's as though when we just sit there and look at each other, everybody, often, like, wherever you are right now, just look around, say you're not at home and physical in anywhere. Nobody's touching anybody. Maybe some couples.
I agree with you. It's a very good, when we were kids, that's what you got before you went to bed. You got a massage.
Uh-huh.
You'd take your shower and you get all powdered up. And you look reasonably clean, and you get in line for a massage, and then off to bed you go. So I like the concept. It's a great concept. I just get nauseous.
Uh-huh. But well, I just feel that maybe if we got back in touch with each other, there wouldn't be so much murder and mayhem and less anxiety and sleepless nights. And it could be a very natural way back to good health.
I want to make a great point. Nobody could argue against it. It's a good idea. Thank you so much for your contribution today.
Thank you.
888-874-4888. We take the short break and come back to more of your thoughts right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and the floor is yours at 888-874-4888. From the Bronx, Gino, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, turn off your radio. We're getting feedback.
I have two of you. What's wrong with that?
Turn off the device that you're listening remotely on.
Yeah. I was running from the other room to get a pen. I was going to jot down a few notes, but you got me real quick. Unlike the last 4 weeks, I almost was late for work. I couldn't do my shopping. I was holding on to the last second. You're a very popular person, young lady.
Well, thank you, and it's because of people like you.
Yeah.
You are the ones who make the program. So what's on your mind today?
Excuse me?
What's on your mind today?
Oh, my mind, yes. Free my mind. Free my spirit. Free me from this sweat. Eutrice. Now, everybody's expanding upon the issue, which is always great to enlarge from caterpillar view to the butterfly view. And Gary's had on people, Peter Phillips the other day, which that young lady went to hear the man speak last night, I believe. I was working. And he had on Daniel Sheehan talking about, the powers that be. Now, this is all connecting. I would like to put the telescope a little more, the magnifying glass. And it pertains to a particular video when I met you at the church. Have you seen the Casey video, The Beautiful Dreamer?
No.
Okay,
no.
So we can't get too much into talking about it. But I will just say this then. A couple weeks ago, Bonnie Faulkner on the sister station there, Guns and Butter, I believe it is, she had on Dr. Robert Schock. Do you know Dr. Robert Schock?
No.
Well, he shocked the system. He's an archaeologist who went to those fancy universities, and it took him a long while to confirm what people like Edgar and many others were saying, that the pyramids were built three times longer in time frame than what they're saying. Well, Dr. Schock was on Barney's show, and he said, when people said I said that pyramids were built around 10,500 B.C., they said, "Oh, you're trying to confirm the message of that psychic guy Casey." And he says, "I wasn't ignorant. I've heard of Casey, but I didn't study him. I'm just doing my science," because he showed the rains were coming down very heavily after the Ice Age, and they came down vertically upon the Sphinx, and it wasn't, even though when the Nile was closer to the pyramid and Sphinx, it wasn't horizontal lines. They were massive indentations vertically on the Sphinx. And so it was great to hear, a scientist, because she does the heavy shows too, like you, and, the powers that be, and, Kennedy assassination, everything that we know about. And that group of people who tried to kill Roosevelt, and that General Smedley Butler, the highest-ranking Marine who was tried to be enlisted, they tried to enlist him to lead a coup against Roosevelt, and he testified in Congress against such. That these major,
but you're taking us all over the place. I'm looking for you to take a direct line to an opinion of some sort.
Okay,
is
so
that
my main
gonna
point
happen?
Is, this is my main point of all of it. Nobody's going to stop these people. Roosevelt could hardly do it. I mean, he did somewhat. He stopped them. He closed the bank with the Nazis and the Bushes and Dulleses. Kennedy couldn't do it. In fact, they took him out. We're not going to stop him, Gary. No, ain't going to stop him. Your chief leaders ain't going to stop him. I ain't going to stop him. But the reason I persist in bringing a spotlight on this particular figure, known as Edgar Casey, who, as I said, had no education other than eighth grade, but could diagnose people from a distance, written about everywhere where he lived in every state, two pages in the New York Times in 1910, it validates that the invisible world is real, if it's true, for those who are very skeptical, and you should be, because even God says, prove me, that he could see further than the eagle and travel faster than the Concorde and diagnose and what's wrong and what to do. It validates the invisible world is real, and the mirror has to put up to these people that karma is as real as gravity. They don't believe this stuff, but you don't have to believe in gravity. But they will fall, and that's the only message we could give them as loving human beings who are keeping our humanity, and that's why that mirror needs to be presented to them in your show. Gary's got a little, he was going to make a documentary, he said, 4 years ago, but he's went off the track with that a bit. So it needs to be put out there. because there's nobody. He keeps talking about Benjamin Bannister broke the mile on the 4 minutes. This is the Benjamin Bannister of the spiritual realm in America with documentation. So when you see that video, I could go further in and you could give me questions or we could go back and forth for the audience. But until you see it, I can't go too much more into it other than saying there's nothing else that these people that's going to be a loving reminder to these people, because going up into a riot or going up against them, they'll put us in prison, the camps they got. They'll put martial law. That ain't going to do it. The earth changes are coming. California.
All right. We get the idea, the general idea. I thank you for it, but I wish you would work a little bit more on it and, you know, be a bit more cogent so we can follow you, you know, in a linear fashion. We can follow you from beginning to end. So promise me you'll work on that. Okay. So you hung up. Patricia from Maryland, you're on the air. And welcome.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. I'm hanging in.
Yes, ain't we all. I just wanted to say, I met you years ago, and we were in a meeting, so that's where I met you at WBAI. But that was years ago. I'm just so glad for your success, for your help. I'm so happy about that, and Gary has helped me with a lot of situations with that, too. But I love the person that talked before this gentleman about hugging and touching, because that is my medicine on a daily basis. And I'll tell you, I just came out of Michael's, and everybody knows me there, and we all get, she just gave me a hug. We just get hugs. I don't care if I'm going to the cleaners, you know. Supermarkets, they know me, and they give me hugs. And I'm telling you, it's just like he said, it's giving it and getting it back. But giving it is more wonderful. She's just waiting for me to give her a hug. So I just needed to share about that because, oh, and you were talking about your, I'm all over the place too, but it was just a happy thing, and I needed to talk about it. And you talked about getting nauseous about with massages. Well, I get nauseous when I see your president talking. Okay. So that's it for me. I just wanted to get that all out and see your mind Friday. Thank God for it. And you keep continuing to take care of yourself. I'm so happy for you.
Well, I'm giving you a hug right now. You probably don't even know.
I love it.
It was said to me that I have an over empathic system. And that's why I get nauseous. But I love giving massages, and I'm pretty good at it, actually.
No, I'm not pretty surprised.
I'm pretty good at it.
Yeah,
because everybody in my family, after my father said, okay, you know what a massage is, you guys figure it out. I am not about to give 9 kids massages before y'all go to bed. You figure it out. And so we ended up giving each other massages at night.
Wow. So, that was a wonderful idea, too. I love that. I love that when you shared that. That was wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your long-distance hug.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime for you.
Thanks so much. From California, David, how are you doing?
Oh, good. Therese, long time no talk. You know, I didn't hear how you opened your show, so I don't know what theme you were exactly going on, but to keep with the last couple of callers, you're familiar with the word prognostication?
Yes.
And Gnostics is the same root. It spurred me to call it the guy about 2 calls ago. You know, he basically was talking about prognostication and the idea that you can, was it Edgar Casey, could just look at a person and know what he was, what illness he was suffering from. You know, a certain amount of that comes from experience, but the sort of an intuition backed by science sure makes a difference. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm wondering the same thing. I thought we lost you there for a minute.
Yeah, I heard a big beep. Somebody's probably trying to call me, but I'll let the Pope wait. He wanted to play poker tonight. You know, the other thing I was going to raise was the a couple of the other shows today are talking about whether or not computers are damaging our psyches, that kids are not reading as much anymore, that too much electronics, it fills our minds with chimeras and doesn't really get locked into the brain as solidly as books used to do. And you're probably familiar, you remember how the Jews, Jesus was dealing with both the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and I think the Pharisees like to go with the written word and the Sadducees like to go with the spoken word. So the idea that they would never write, Sadducees pretty much would never write anything down, and so literacy was not necessarily the high point of theirs, but the idea that the written word was with the scribes, and they had a whole different way of approaching life. And so that's really gotten us, there are people that fight that still. And it's kind of interesting with the world of electronics. It kind of gives people an excuse not to write anything down. It's all just in the ether and momentary.
Well, actually, this is one of the, I would call it a cultural bias. The whole definition of literacy. Societies develop literacies, plural. You were not only expected to be literate about your culture, you were to be literate about your religion, and you were to be literate about the ways of the world. I mean, it was not just about reading. Literacy was about integrating knowledge of the world into daily life.
Sure.
So that even today, you have very educated people who are as ignorant as they come. They have no knowledge. For example, just yesterday, the Fox News, in discussing the death of Aretha Franklin, had on the screen a picture of Patti LaBelle. Now, that's literacy. If you were culturally literate, there's no way you could make such an awful, stupid, insulting mistake.
Right.
So they're not literate.
Well, much less that maybe they're doing it intentionally. You look at, doesn't Rupert Murdoch...
No, they just, this is just a level of literacy, well, illiteracy, that we see all the time, where white controlled institutions have no clue about the black world or the world of color. They have no clue. They are totally illiterate.
I don't disagree.
Illiterate about what's going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I'm just saying Rupert Murdoch, if you remember, I mean, Rupert Murdoch, it was known before he bought Fox News, when he came from Australia first. And he was like a huckster and a con artist, and he had like the sleazy paper. And now he owns the National Geographic. Now he's going out of his way to buy some of the most famous, scientific magazines. And so he's intentionally dumbing us down. I wouldn't know
whether you could personally accuse him of that, because Rupert Murdoch was not responsible for yesterday's gaffe.
But
he has a staff, a very well-paid staff, supposedly very literate, supposedly very culturally literate.
No.
So you see, we have to change the term. And we have to understand that most people don't understand the term literate. When you are literate, it means you are conversant with elements in a particular area. You are conversant with a culture. You are conversant with a language. You have a knowledge, a working knowledge, and you are able to therefore put all the pieces together for the most part, and you can manage without harming anybody.
Well,
so when we talk about computers and whether they're threatening the future because they are discouraging children from leading. It's just that children and younger people have acquired a different and new form of literacy. That's all.
Oh, I don't disagree with that. But I'm just saying that Rupert is more, he started at the end of the Vietnam War when they knew that they were going to have to confuse the baby boom. They were going to have to confuse the hippies and confuse the world that was trying to go into the alternative to, you know, military industrial complex. You know, the people that wanted solar and alternative energy and an alternative economics and future, an expansive future. Rupert was there to make things sleazy, and he was allowed to buy the Wall Street Journal to basically trick the Wall Street.
You know, you sound like you're blaming him, or you despise that. Well, here's the thing. Here's the other way of seeing it. He became extremely literate about what oligarchy means. He wanted to make a lot of money, and he devoted himself to studying how that is done.
Well,
Have you ever
studied J. Edgar Hoover?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever studied J. Edgar Hoover?
I haven't studied him. I have read a lot about him. He has not been a point of study for me.
Well, the angle that I'm going to raise, back in the early 90s, there were a couple of biographies that came out about him, and there were holes, you know, the ones that especially glamorized the fact that he was gay and clamping down on everybody. But there were two biographies, and one of them showed that he knew in the late 30s, 40s, when Meyer Lansky was doing money laundering for all of the families for the mob, that he was putting 2.5% into Wall Street per year. In 10 years' time, that would have had 25% of Wall Street controlled by the mob. In 20 years' time, it would have been 50%. Well, by the 1980s, it was well over 100%. And Rupert Murdoch was there to buy the Wall Street Journal to make sure that the mob was fat and happy and keeping the businessmen, you know, grasping at straws rather than doing the stable things. And Rupert Murdoch's job title basically is to keep organized crime happy and to dumb down America so we don't figure out that our lives are being run by dumb thugs rather than by anybody that's got an intelligent plan.
No, well, you know, people have different theories. I happen not to think that about Rupert Murdoch. I see him just like any other voracious man wanting to be the richest person and therefore the most powerful person in the world. You know, J. Edgar Hoover being gay, that was not his problem. Abraham Lincoln was gay. You know, we have several presidents who have been gay.
Well, you know,
but they haven't been that malicious. They haven't been that nasty. Let's just concede that the difference with J. Edgar Hoover was that he was a horrible human being.
Well, you know, he was totally stifled.
Being gay was not his problem.
He was totally a horrible
human being.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the very beginning of one of those books, it mentions that his grandfather was black and that he had to hide from his grandfather. He was never in a photograph with his grandfather after the age of 8. And that he passed, and because he passed, he made it into the Justice Department, he made it into college, he made it into, you know, un-American activities and chasing Dillinger and all of the different things about his life. But he got it because he stifled himself. He couldn't acknowledge, he couldn't grow free. He became hugely powerful, but he was still trapped. It's interesting. I'm calling you from San Francisco, and apparently, you remember the old underground comics from the 60s. J. Edgar Hoover apparently subscribed to them all because he was totally intrigued by freedom, but he was terrified by it, too. And
people have all these theories. There's a lot more simple stuff to understand about J. Edgar Hoover. He was a sick man.
Oh, he was, absolutely.
He was a very sick man. and the complexities of which I don't think we would ever know how complex it was in how many ways he was sick.
Sure. Well, to this day, we're still living by some of those horrible standards that he helped create. Like in the 1920s, if it was in 1921, they did the Palmer Raids, and they rounded up all the socialists. And I mean, the socialists were a regular political party. You know, the communists actually were a regular political party, too. And they outlawed political parties, rounded them up, and deported them. And that was J. Edgar Hoover's job in 1921. Then he tried to clean up his act by going after the, you know, gangsters. But he was really in league with the biggest gangsters. And he was just crushing the competition for the biggest gangsters. So you're right about him being a horrible figure, but he allowed the biggest gangsters to come to power, and then the military-industrial complex gets in league with the biggest gangsters. America has been tormented by these people for 75 or going on 100 years now, since it was 1921. And Roy Cohn, Donald Trump, and Paul Manafort and Roger Stone were all acolytes of Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn was considered one of the most evil lawyers, and he was right there with J. Edgar Hoover and Joe McCarthy. And so we're still living by the most
evil. He was a very sick gay man.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I've tried to make a point that simply because people attribute, you know, such and such a person is gay. Look, it's you have that dichotomy all throughout society. That's not what made them gay, or that's not what made them bad. They were just horrible people to start with.
Yeah, and it's the S&M aspect of it. That's one of the reasons, if you ever read a lot about spy novels, you know, if somebody is gay, they were quite likely to be blackmailed. And so one of the ideas of allowing people to be out now is that frees them from being blackmailed. And so you can get a lot more done. The economy becomes stronger. In fact, it's interesting. When you start looking at the abortion issue, organized crime practiced most of the abortions. If you wanted to get an abortion before 1972, you pretty much had to go to organized crime to get it done, and they'd give you a free blackmail along with it.
Unless you were wealthy enough.
Oh, no,
to pay whoever it is to get what you want when you needed it. We have very distorted views of our society. And there's a lot of storytelling, and we fall for the storytelling. It conditions our minds. You know, the program opened with someone taking offense to the name Chitlin Circuit, when he should really be very proud of it. But the history is written in such a way as to make him resent the name. So what I'm saying is we are shaped purposely. We are shaped, our thinking, our minds are shaped to think of good people as bad, of bad people as good. We have a person in the White House who I have contended from day one is not of sound mind.
Right.
But look at what they're bending backwards to make all kinds of explanations as to why he's actually sane. Nobody is saying out loud, although some psychiatrists did say they worry about his state of mind, but generally, the society has accepted, whether they, quote, like him or they, quote, don't like him, they're not questioning his sanity, which is the first thing they ought to question.
Sure.
Thanks a lot. That brings us to the end of our program today. Thank you all for contributing. I always like Fridays. I get to meet you on a different level, and it's more personal, and I really do cherish it. Have yourselves a really good weekend. Surround yourselves with very positive people. Secure yourselves, meaning your mind. It's the best asset you have. And we'll see each other on Monday. Bye-bye.